100 years ago, these fields would have been the worst place on earth to find yourself. Shattered, hellish landscapes. A terrain pockmarked with shell holes, many of them filled with water, almost impossible to cross. We have accounts of men and animals literally drowning in the water and the mud. Today, it looks like beautiful rolling farmland. The sun's been out. It's very, very hard to take yourself back 100 years to that crucible of violence that was the Third Battle of Ypres, or Passchendaele.
The air was boiling with the turmoil of the shells flying through it. We were thrown about in the aircraft, rocking from side to side. Below us was mud, filth, smashed trenches.
In the autumn of 1917, Royal Flying Corps officer Norman McMillan looked down on this area from the air.
Broken wire, broken machine gun posts, broken limbers, rubbish, wreckage of aeroplanes, bits of men. And then, in the midst of it all, when we were flying at 400 feet, I spotted a German machine gun post and went down. It was only time to dive and fire, climb and zoom, and on to the next target. And there we were, in the midst of that inferno, shooting at men who'd cast themselves into the mud to try and escape our bullets. We flew on rocking out of that inferno and escaped, turned left. And I felt that never at any time had I passed through such an extraordinary experience and real damnation on the ground. And as we came out of it, I felt that we had escaped from one of the most evil things that I have ever seen at any time during that war.
In our language, the name Ypres has simply become shorthand for the most hellish conditions imaginable.
I try to tell people, if they could just imagine going up into a battle, into Ypres. There are no trenches. The whole ground had been saturated with shelling. Everything was shell holes. There were no trees, there was nothing, not a hedge nor a blade of grass. And each shell hole was touching the other. And the way you made a trench was to dig between one shell hole and another. That's the kind of living you made. And don't forget, half these shell holes covered in water, covered in blood, covered in something else. Mules, dead men, legs, arms, everything.
The track stopped at Langemark. And there at Langemark, the place, of course, had been flattened to the ground, and there was a board at the side of the road propped up, and on it was stenciled, "This was Langemark." But that was the only evidence there was that a town ever stood there.
And we'd got through a place called Sanctuary Wood, making our way up to the front line. And it was hell's delight. There was not a soul about, not a tree, not a mark, no nothing. And all, of course, all these very lights up, the whole place looked dreadful, you know, the whole place. Pieces of equipment, pieces of mules, pieces of men's arms. No idea.
Before the war, Ypres had been a historic market town, packed with rich medieval buildings, all of them evidence of its prosperous past when it had been at the crossroads of northwest Europe. Early in the war, British soldiers remembered seeing its spectacular 13th century clothall when they first arrived in the area, and the town was surrounded by farmland and picturesque villages. But the advent of industrial war obliterated all of that. The fine buildings were reduced to ghastly shells by high explosives. The farmland was transformed into a morass of mud as the centuries-old drainage system was pulverised, and the woodlands and copses that dotted the region became patches of splintered stumps. Norman Macmillan's perspective from the air is amplified by those experiencing the war in the Ypres salient at ground level in the autumn of 1917. Alfred Griffin, Ulrich Burke, Donald Price and Charles Carrington were there.
Of course, there was too many dead bodies for the sanitary people and to take away.
We stepped over them every morning. Never failed to step over a man and one or two dead men. It was a nightmare because all you had was a couple of duckboards side by side, and either side of it was about 10 feet of mud, top of a tank sticking out of it here and there.
you had to go on duckboards. And if you fell off a duckboard, without any exaggeration, if you weren't pulled out, your forehead got sucked down with all this mud. It was that thick and that dreadful.
But you imagine the agony of a fellow for 24 hours standing nearly up to his waist in mud with a couple of woolly beef tins trying, or his mess tin, trying to get the water out of this shell hole. And he had all day and all night to stay there for about 6 days. And that was his existence.
It rained and rained. I always remember that year. It rained nearly every day. You never got dry. And the mud there, it was the front line at Ypres, what was called the front line. You could never be sure of it.
There was generally one just arriving and another one just beginning. It would burst with a shattering shock, which always upset me very much. I've always been very much upset by noise. I hate noise. And it took 5 or 6 seconds, perhaps, to come. And in 5 or 6 seconds, you can pass through quite a number of psychological changes. Your mind can get through various phases. All day long, one had nothing to do but to sit in the mud, shivering, wet and cold, with no hot food, very short of sleep, being very heavily and very systematically shelled. It would suddenly get louder and louder until it was like the roar of an aeroplane coming into land on the tarmac. And at a certain point, your nerve would break and you'd throw yourself down in the mud and cringe in the mud till it was past.
There was basically a siege that went on here as the front line surrounded Ypres on three sides throughout most of the war, from December 1914 right up until the last weeks of the First World War. The Battle of Passchendaele, as it's known now, is, after the Battle of the Somme, the bloodiest in British history, and yet it's often overshadowed by the horrors of what went on the year before in 1916. At the time, it was seen as almost the nadir of the British Army's experience on the Western Front. The weather was particularly bad, and any lessons that had been learned since the brutal fighting in 1915-1916 seemed to have been wasted as the British Army failed time after time to penetrate through German lines and get to the green fields beyond. The irrigation system had been destroyed by the shelling in the previous couple of years, so it was impossible to drain this low-lying ground, and the result was a nightmare.
As soon as a man was wounded and he fell, he never had a chance. I mean, that thick mud, it was like liquid cream. With churning up with the shells all the time, it was being stirred up like a cake mixture. And the horses going through it, though they had duckboards, the duckboards would be covered in mud with the feet, and they'd slip off.
The Third Battle of Ypres began on the 31st of July, 100 years ago, and dragged on for more than 3 months. August was a write-off. Rain later in the autumn also played its part in slowing the battle down. Weeks and weeks of wet weather gave rise to the conditions for which the battle is still remembered a century on. Horrific, deadly mud. It was said that when men got stuck in this mud, their backs were broken as rescuers tried to haul them out with ropes, often tied to horses and mules.
Just imagine, you want the piddle, you want the crap. How are you doing it? What have you got to do? Pop your head over the top and you fall it. You've got to undress. Take your uniform, all this, everything out. Get your trousers down. Imagine it. And that's normal. They took it as read. But people don't imagine things like that, you see.
Another extra chore was lime had to come up and be chucked on the back of these things because the open excreta was being just chucked out. You see, you had to chuck lime down. Otherwise, when you came crawling up or walking up, you'd be covered in it. Oh, it was a terrible existence.
Even tanks with their caterpillar tracks were defeated by the mud. Every operation, every movement was smothered by the dissolving ground beneath their feet. Richard Talbot Kelly, Jack Dillon and Richard Tobin still vividly recalled the desperate scenes 50 years later when they're interviewed by the BBC.
Very viscous indeed, very tenacious. It stuck to you all over. It slowed you down. It got into the bottom of your trousers. It wasn't liquid. It wasn't porridge. It was a curious kind of sucking kind of mud, because when you got off this track with your load, it drew at you, not like a quicksand, but a real monster that sucked at you.
If you're wounded and you slip off the duck boards, you just sank into the mud, fall in with decomposed bodies of humans and mules. And if you're wounded and slipped off, well, then that was the end of you.
One was as afraid of getting drowned as one was of getting hit by shells. When one woke up in the morning in the little scrape which you'd scratched in the ground, you felt the water bubbling and oozing in the small of your back.
I've seen men coming out covered in mud. They just scraped the mud from their eyes. They had in their hands what looked like a muddy bough of a tree. It was their Lewis gun.
At Passchendaele, the smells were very marked. The first smell one got going up L track was a very, very sweet smell, which only later you found out was a smell of decaying bodies, mules or men. And over that, as a sort of, like a chord of C, E, G, this is the E of the chord, you got the smell of chlorine gas, which was pear drops. But the same kind of pear drops you'd known as a child. And the more attractive, in fact, the pear drop smell got, the more gas there was and the more dangerous it was.
And in most places, if shells start dropping, you run to the right or run to the left and get some cover. But you're on the duckboard, you couldn't run. There was mud to your right and mud to your left, and you had to face it and go on.
It was a particularly tragic battle. There were very high casualties. It proved very difficult to impose any order on this battlefield without things like portable wireless sets and other ways of communicating that would have been available to more modern armies. The high hopes, the improved tactics, new tanks on the battlefield, better aircraft above it, all, in the end, counted for fairly little as the brutal logic of the Western Front took hold of operations here.
Hopeless. The battalion came from an ordinary trench as a battalion, but the men struggled back in twos and threes, and some a day late. They hadn't been found, they hadn't been told, they'd been relieved. Possibly they didn't know they were there. Passchendaele was the infantryman's graveyard. We called it the slaughterhouse. And even the most seasoned veteran felt he'd be lucky if he got there and came back. You know, wanted to go to that sector again.